The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, this is Margaret Dixon at Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Radio. As you remember from last time, this is a two-parter, so let me do a little catch-up for those who didn't know. The beginning of the story, we are reading The Dream Woman by Wilkie Collins. And last time, our narrator has come upon an inn with a stable hand guy named Isaac Scatcherd, who seems to be having this scary recurring dream of this ghostly woman with a knife. And he asks the innkeeper, what's up with that? Innkeeper says that Isaac told him this story. And that's the one we're reading. So it's a story within a story. Isaac stayed in an inn one night when he was a younger man and was visited by a ghostly vision of a woman stabbing him. And he's come back to his mother's house and is about to tell her about this crazy ghostly lady. Pretty much sums it up. Part 3. His mother came out eagerly to receive him. His face told her in a moment that something was wrong. "I've lost the place, but that's my luck. I dreamed an ill dream last night, Mother. Or maybe I saw a ghost. Take it either way, it scared me out of my senses, and I'm not my own man again yet." "Isaac, your face frightens me. Come into the fire. Come in and tell Mother all about it." He was as anxious to tell as she was to hear, for it had been his hope all the way home that his mother, with her quicker capacity and superior knowledge, might be able to throw some light on the mystery which he could not clear up for himself. His memory of the dream was still mechanically vivid, though his thoughts were entirely confused by it. His mother's face grew paler and paler as he went on. She never interrupted him by so much as a single word, but when he had done, she moved her chair closer to his, put her arm round his neck, and said to him, "Isaac, you dreamed your ill dream on this Wednesday morning. What time was it when you saw the fair woman with the knife in her hand?" Isaac reflected on what the landlord had said when they had passed by the clock on his leaving the inn. Aloud as nearly as he could for the time that must have elapsed between the unlocking of his bedroom door and the paying of his bill just before going away, he answered, "Somewhere about 2 o'clock in the morning." His mother suddenly quitted her hold of his neck and struck her hands together with a gesture of despair. "This Wednesday is your birthday, Isaac, and 2 o'clock in the morning is the time when you were born." Isaac's capacities were not quick enough to catch the infection of his mother's superstitious dread. He was amazed and a little startled also, when she suddenly rose from her chair, opened her old writing desk, took pen, ink, and paper, and then said to him, "Your memory is but a poor one, Isaac, and now I'm an old woman, mine's not much better. I want all about this dream of yours to be as well known to both of us, years hence, as it is now. Tell me over again all you told me a minute ago when you spoke of what the woman with the knife looked like." Isaac obeyed and marveled much as he saw his mother carefully set down on paper the very words that he was saying. "Light gray eyes," she wrote as they came to the descriptive part, "with a droop in the left eyelid, flaxen hair with a gold-yellow streak in it, white arms with a down upon them, little lady's hand with a reddish look about the fingernails, clasp knife with a buckhorn handle that seemed as good as new." To these particulars, Mrs. Scatcherd added the year, month, day of the week, and time in the morning when the woman of the dream appeared to her son. She then locked up the paper carefully in her writing desk. Neither on that day nor on any day after could her son introduce her to return to the matter of the dream. She obstinately kept her thoughts about it to herself and even refused to refer again to the paper in her writing desk. Ere long, Isaac grew weary of attempting to make her break her resolute silence, and time, which sooner or later wears out all things, gradually wore out the impression produced on him by the dream. He began by thinking of it carelessly, and he ended by not thinking of it at all. This result was the more easily brought about by the advent of some important changes for the better in his prospects, which commenced not long after his terrible night's experience at the inn. He reaped at last the reward of his long and patient suffering under adversity by getting an excellent place, keeping it for 7 years, and leaving it, on the death of his master, not only with an excellent character, but also with a comfortable annuity bequeathed to him as a reward for saving his mistress's life in a carriage accident. Thus it happened that Isaac Scatcherd returned to his old mother 7 years after the time of the dream at the inn, with an annual sum of money at his disposal, sufficient to keep them both in ease and independence for the rest of their lives. The mother, whose health had been bad of late years, profited so much by the care bestowed upon her and by freedom from money anxieties, that when Isaac's birthday came round, she was able to sit up comfortably at table and dine with him. On that day, as the evening drew on, Mrs. Scatcherd discovered that a bottle of tonic medicine, which she was accustomed to take and in which she had fancied that a dose or more was still left, happened to be empty. Isaac immediately volunteered to go to the chemist's and get it filled again. It was as rainy and bleak an autumn's night as on the memorable past occasion when he lost his way and slept at the roadside inn. On going into the chemist's shop, he was passed hurriedly by a poorly dressed woman coming out of it. The glimpse he had of her face struck him, and he looked back after her as she descended the doorsteps. "You're noticing that woman," said the chemist's apprentice behind the counter. "It's my opinion there's something wrong with her. She's been asking for laudanum to put to a bad tooth. Master's out for half an hour, and I told her I wasn't allowed to sell poison to strangers in his absence. She laughed in a strange way and said she would come back in half an hour. If she expects Master to serve her, I think she'll be disappointed. It's a case of suicide, sir, if ever there was one yet." These words added immeasurably to the sudden interest in the woman which Isaac had felt at the first sight of her face. After he had got the medicine bottle filled, he looked about anxiously for her as soon as he was out in the street. She was walking slowly up and down on the opposite side of the road. With his heart, very much to his own surprise, beating fast, Isaac crossed over and spoke to her. He asked if she was in any distress. She pointed to her torn shawl, her scanty dress, her crushed, dirty bonnet, then moved under a lamp so as to let the light fall on her stern, pale, but still most beautiful face. "I look like a comfortable, happy woman, don't I?" she said with a bitter laugh. She spoke with a purity of intonation which Isaac had never heard before from other than ladies' lips. Her slightest action seemed to have the easy, negligent grace of a thoroughbred woman. Her skin, for all its poverty-stricken paleness, was as delicate as if her life had been passed in the enjoyment of every social comfort that wealth can purchase. Even her small, finely shaped hands, gloveless as they were, had not lost their whiteness. Little by little, in answer to his questions, the sad story of the woman came out. There is no need to relate it here. It is told over and over again in police reports and paragraphs descriptive of attempted suicides. "My name is Rebecca Murdoch," said the woman as she ended. "I have 9 pence left, and I thought of spending it at the chemist's over the way in securing a passage to the other world. Whatever it is, it can't be worse to me than this, so why should I stop here?" Besides, the natural compassion and sadness moved in his heart by what he heard. Isaac felt within him some mysterious influence at work all the time the woman was speaking, which utterly confused his ideas and almost deprived him of his powers of speech. All that he could say in answer to her last reckless words was that he would prevent her from attempting her own life if he followed her about all night to do it. His rough, trembling earnestness seemed to impress her. "I won't occasion you that trouble," she answered when he repeated his threat. "You have given me a fancy for living by speaking kindly to me. No need for the mockery of protestations and promises. You may believe me without them. Come to Fuller's Meadow tomorrow at 12, and you will find me alive to answer for myself. No, no money. My 9 pence will do to get me as good a night's lodging as I want." She nodded and left him. He made no attempt to follow. He felt no suspicion that she was deceiving him. "It's strange, but I can't help believing her," he said to himself and walked away bewildered towards home. On entering the house, his mind was still so completely absorbed by its new subject of interest that he took no notice of what his mother was doing when he came in with the bottle of medicine. She had opened her old writing desk in his absence and was now reading a paper attentively that lay inside it. On every birthday of Isaac since she had written down the particulars of his dreams from his own lips, she had been accustomed to read that same paper and ponder over it in private. The next day, he went to Fuller's Meadow. He had done only right in believing her so implicitly. She was there, punctual to a minute, to answer for herself. The last left faint defenses in Isaac's heart against the fascination which a word or look from her began inscrutably to exercise over him sank down and vanished before her forever on that memorable morning. When a man, previously insensible to the influences of woman, forms an attachment in middle life, the instances are rare indeed, let the warning circumstances be what they may, in which he is found capable of freeing himself from the tyranny of the new ruling passion. The charm of being spoken to familiarly, fondly, and gratefully by a woman whose language and manner still retained enough of their early refinement to hint at the high social station that she had lost would have been a dangerous luxury to a man of Isaac's rank at the age of 20. But it was far more than that. It was certain ruin to him, now that his heart was opening unworthily to a new influence at that middle time of life when strong feelings of all kinds, once implanted, strike root most stubbornly in a man's moral nature. A few more stolen interviews after that first morning in Fuller's Meadow completed his infatuation. In less than a month from the time when he first met her, Isaac Scatcherd had consented to give Rebecca Murdoch a new interest in existence and a chance of recovering the character she had lost by promising to make her his wife. She had taken possession not of his passions only, but of his faculties as well. All the mind he had, he put into her keeping. She directed him on every point, even instructing him how to break the news of his approaching marriage in the safest manner to his mother. "If you tell her how you met me and who I am at first," said the cunning woman, "she will move heaven and earth to prevent our marriage. Say I am the sister of one of your fellow servants. Ask her to see me before you get into any more particulars, and leave it to me to do the rest. I mean to make her love me next best to you, Isaac, before she knows anything of who I really am." The motive of the deceit was sufficient to sanctify it to Isaac. The stratagem proposed relieved him of his one great anxiety and quieted his uneasy conscience on the subject of his mother. Still, there was something wanting to perfect his happiness, something that he could not realize, something mysteriously untraceable, and yet something that perpetually made itself felt, not when he was absent from Rebecca Murdoch, but strange to say, when he was actually in her presence. She was kindness itself with him. She never made him feel his inferior capacities and inferior manners. She showed the sweetest anxiety to please him in the smallest trifles. But, in spite of all these attractions, he never could quite feel at his ease with her. At their first meeting, there had mingled with his admiration, when he looked in her face, a faint, involuntary feeling of doubt, whether that face was entirely strange to him. No after-familiarity had the slightest effect on this inexplicable, wearisome uncertainty. Concealing the truth as he had been directed, he announced his marriage engagement precipitately and confusedly to his mother on the day when he contracted it. Poor Mrs. Scatcherd showed her perfect confidence in her son by flinging her arms round his neck and giving him joy of having found at last, in the sister of one of his fellow servants, a woman to comfort and care for him after his mother was gone. She was all eagerness to see the woman of her son's choice, and the next day was fixed for the introduction. It was a bright, sunny morning, and the little cottage parlor was full of light, as Mrs. Scatcherd, happy and expectant, dressed for the occasion in her Sunday gown, sat waiting for her son and her future daughter-in-law. Punctual to the appointed time, Isaac hurriedly and nervously led his promised wife into the room. His mother rose to receive her, advanced a few steps, smiling, looked Rebecca full in the eyes, and suddenly stopped. Her face, which had been flushed the moment before, turned white in an instant. Her eyes lost their expression of softness and kindness and assumed a blank look of terror. Her outstretched hands fell to her sides, and she staggered back a few steps with a low cry to her son. "Isaac!" she whispered, clutching him fast by the arm when he asked alarmedly if she was taken ill. "Isaac, does that woman's face remind you of nothing?" Before he could answer, before he could look round to where Rebecca stood, astonished and angered by her reception, at the lower end of the room, his mother pointed impatiently to her writing desk and gave him the key. "Open it," she said in a quick, breathless whisper. "What does this mean? Why am I treated as if I had no business here? Does your mother want to insult me?" asked Rebecca angrily. "Open it and give me the paper in the left-hand drawer. Quick, quick, for heaven's sake," said Mrs. Scatcherd, shrinking further back in terror. Isaac gave her the paper. She looked it over eagerly for a moment, then followed Rebecca, who was now turning away haughtily to leave the room, and caught her by the shoulder, abruptly raised the long, loose sleeve of her gown, and glanced at her hand and arm. Something like fear began to steal over the angry expression of Rebecca's face as she shook herself free from the old woman's grasp. "Mad," she said to herself. "And Isaac never told me." With those few words, she left the room. Isaac was hastening after her when his mother turned and stopped his further progress. It wrung his heart to see the misery and terror in her face as she looked at him. "Light gray eyes," she said in low, mournful, awestruck tones, pointing towards the open door. "A droop in the left eyelid, flaxen hair with a gold-yellow streak in it, white arms with a down on them, little lady's hand with a reddish look under the fingernails. The dream woman, Isaac, the dream woman." That faint, cleaving doubt, which he had never been able to shake off in Rebecca Murdoch's presence, was fatally set at rest forever. He had seen her face then before. 7 years before, on his birthday, in the bedroom of the lonely inn. "Be warned, oh my son, be warned! Isaac, Isaac, let her go, and do you stop with me?" Something darkened the parlor window as those words were said. A sudden chill ran through him, and he glanced sidelong at the shadow. Rebecca Murdoch had come back. She was peering in curiously at them over the low window blind. "I have promised to marry, Mother," he said, "and marry I must." The tears came into his eyes as he spoke and dimmed his sight, but he could just discern the fatal face outside moving away again from the window. His mother's head sank lower. "Are you faint?" he whispered. "Broken-hearted, Isaac." He stooped down and kissed her. The shadow, as he did so, returned to the window, and the fatal face peered in curiously once more. Part 4. 3 weeks after that day, Isaac and Rebecca were man and wife. All that was hopelessly dogged and stubborn in the man's moral nature seemed to have closed round his fatal passion and to have fixed it unassailably in his heart. After that first interview in the cottage parlor, no consideration could induce Mrs. Scatcherd to see her son's wife again, or even to talk of her when Isaac tried hard to plead her cause after their marriage. This course of conduct was not in any degree occasioned by a discovery of the degradation which Rebecca had lived. There was no question of that between mother and son. There was no question of anything but the fearfully exact resemblance between the living, breathing woman and the specter woman of Isaac's dream. Rebecca, on her side, neither felt nor expressed the slightest sorrow at the estrangement between herself and her mother-in-law. Isaac, for the sake of peace, had never contradicted her first idea that age and long illness had affected Mrs. Scatcherd's mind. He even allowed his wife to upbraid him for not having confessed this to her at the time of their marriage engagement, rather than risk anything by hinting at the truth. The sacrifice of his integrity before his one all-mastering delusion seemed but a small thing, and cost his conscience but little after the sacrifices he had already made. The time of waking from his delusion, the cruel and rueful time, was not far off. After some quiet months of married life, as the summer was ending and the year was getting on towards the month of his birthday, Isaac found his wife altering towards him. She grew sullen and contemptuous. She formed acquaintances of the most dangerous kind, in defiance of his objections, his entreaties, and his commands. And, worst of all, she learnt, ere long, after every fresh difference with her husband, to seek the deadly self-oblivion of drink. Little by little, after the first miserable discovery that his wife was keeping company with drunkards, the shocking certainty forced itself on Isaac that she had grown to be a drunkard herself. He had been in a sadly desponding state for some time before the occurrences of these domestic calamities. His mother's health, as he could but too plainly discern every time he went to see her at the cottage, was failing fast, and he upbraided himself in secret as the cause of the bodily and mental suffering she endured. When to his remorse on his mother's account was added the shame and misery occasioned by the discovery of his wife's degradation, he sank under the double trial, his face began to alter fast, and he looked what he was, a spirit-broken man. His mother, still struggling bravely against the illness that was hurrying her to her grave, was the first to notice the sad alteration in him, and the first to hear of his last, worst trouble with his wife. She could only weep bitterly on the day when he made his humiliating confession. But on the next occasion when he went to see her, she had taken a resolution, in reference to his domestic afflictions, which astonished and even alarmed him. He found her dressed to go out, and on asking the reason, received this answer. "I am not long for this world, Isaac," she said, "and I shall not feel easy on my deathbed unless I have done my best to the last to make my son happy. I mean to put my own fears and my own feelings out of the question, and to go with you to your wife and try what I can do to reclaim her. Give me your arm, Isaac, and let me do the last thing I can in this world to help my son before it is too late." He could not disobey her, and they walked together slowly towards his miserable home. It was only 1 o'clock in the afternoon when they reached the cottage where he lived. It was their dinner hour, and Rebecca was in the kitchen. He was thus able to take his mother quietly into the parlor and then prepare his wife for the interview. She had fortunately drunk but little at that early hour, and she was less sullen and capricious than usual. He returned to his mother with his mind tolerably at ease. His wife soon followed him into the parlor, and the meeting between her and Mrs. Scatcherd passed off better than he had ventured to anticipate, though he observed with secret apprehension that his mother, resolutely as she controlled herself in other respects, could not look his wife in the face when she spoke to her. It was a relief to him, therefore, when Rebecca began to... It was a relief to him, therefore, when Rebecca began to lay the cloth. She laid the cloth, brought in the bread tray, and cut a slice from the loaf for her husband, then returned to the kitchen. At that moment, Isaac, still anxiously watching his mother, was startled by seeing the same ghastly change pass over her face, which had altered it so awfully on the morning when Rebecca and she first met. Before he could say a word, she whispered with a look of horror, "Take me back! Home! Home again, Isaac! Come with me and never go back again!" He was afraid to ask for an explanation. He could only sign to her to be silent and help her quickly to the door. As they passed the bread tray on the table, she stopped and pointed to it. "Did you see what your wife cut your bread with?" she asked in a low whisper. "No, mother, I was not noticing. What was it?" "Look!" He did look. A new clasp knife with a buckhorn handle lay with the loaf in the bread tray. He stretched out his hand shudderingly to possess himself of it, but at the same time there was a noise in the kitchen and his mother caught at his arm. "The knife of the dream! Isaac, I'm faint with fear! Take me away before she comes back!" He was hardly able to support her. The visible, tangible reality of the knife struck him with a panic and utterly destroyed any faint doubts he might have entertained up to this time in relation to the mysterious dream warning of nearly 8 years before. By a last desperate effort, he summoned self-possession enough to help his mother out of the house, so quietly that the dream woman, he thought of her by that name now, did not hear their departure. "Don't go back, Isaac! Don't go back!" implored Mrs. Scatcherd, as he turned to go away, after seeing her safely seated again in her own room. "I must get the knife," he answered under his breath. His mother tried to stop him again, but he hurried out without another word. On his return, he found that his wife had discovered their secret departure from the house. She had been drinking and was in a fury of passion. The dinner in the kitchen was flung under the grate. The cloth was off the parlor table. Where was the knife? Unwisely, he asked for it. She was only too glad of the opportunity of irritating him, which the request afforded her. He wanted the knife, did he? Could he give her a reason why? No. Then he should not have it. Not if he went down on his knees to ask for it. Further recriminations elicited the fact that she had bought it as a bargain, and that she considered it her own especial property. Isaac saw the uselessness of attempting to get the knife by fair means and determined to search for it later in the day in secret. The search was unsuccessful. Night came on and he left the house to walk about the streets. He was afraid now to sleep in the same room with her. 3 weeks passed. Still sullenly enraged with him, she would not give up the knife, and still that fear of sleeping in the same room with her possessed him. He walked about at night, or dozed in the parlor, or sat watching by his mother's bedside. Before the expiration of the first week in the new month, his mother died. It wanted then but 10 days of her son's birthday. She had longed to live till that anniversary. Isaac was present at her death, and her last words in this world were addressed to him. "Don't go back, my son. Don't go back." He was obliged to go back, if it were only to watch his wife. Exasperated to the last degree by his distrust of her, she had revengefully sought to add a sting to his grief during the last day of his mother's illness by declaring that she would assert her right to attend the funeral. In spite of all that he could do or say, she held with wicked pertinacity to her word and on the day appointed for the burial, forced herself, inflamed and shameless with drink, into her husband's presence, and declared that she would walk in the funeral procession to his mother's grave. This last, worst outrage, accompanied by all that was most insulting in word and look, maddened him for the moment. He struck her. The instant the blow was dealt, he repented it. She crouched down, silent, in a corner of the room, and eyed him steadily. It was a look that cooled his hot blood and made him tremble. But there was no time now to think of a means of making atonement. Nothing remained but to risk the worst till the funeral was over. There was but one way of making sure of her. He locked her into her bedroom. When he came back some hours after, he found her sitting, very much altered in look and bearing, by the bedside with a bundle on her lap. She rose and faced him quietly and spoke with a strange stillness in her voice, a strange repose in her eyes, a strange composure in her manner. "No man has ever struck me twice," she said, "and my husband shall have no second opportunity. Set the door open and let me go. From this day forth we see each other no more." Before he could answer, she passed him and left the room. He saw her walk away up the street. Would she return? All that night he watched and waited, but no footstep came near the house. The next night, overcome by fatigue, he lay down in bed in his clothes, with the door locked, the key on the table, and the candle burning. His slumber was not disturbed. The third night, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth passed, and nothing happened. He lay down on the seventh, still in his clothes, still with the door locked, the key on the table and the candle burning, but easier in his mind. Easier in his mind and in perfect health of body when he fell off to sleep. But his rest was disturbed. He woke twice without any sensation of uneasiness. But the third time it was that never-to-be-forgotten shivering of the night at the lonely inn, that dreadful sinking pain at the heart, which once more aroused him in an instant. His eyes opened towards the left-hand side of the bed, and there stood the dream woman again? No, his wife, the living reality with the dream specter's face, in the dream specter's attitude, the fair arm up, the knife clasped in the delicate white hand. He sprang upon her almost at the instant of seeing her, and yet not quickly enough to prevent her from hiding the knife. Without a word from him, without a cry from her, he pinioned her into a chair. With one hand he felt up her sleeve, and there, where the dream woman had hidden the knife, his wife had hidden it. The knife with the buckhorn handle that looked like new. In the despair of that fearful moment, his brain was steady, his heart was calm. He looked at her fixedly, with the knife in his hand, and said these last words. "You told me we should see each other no more, and you have come back. It is my turn now to go, and to go forever. I say that we shall see each other no more, and my word shall not be broken." He left her and set forth into the night. There was a bleak wind abroad, and the smell of recent rain was in the air. The distant church clocks chimed the quarter as he walked rapidly beyond the last houses in the suburb. He asked the first policeman he met what hour that was of which the quarter past had just struck. The man referred sleepily to his watch and answered, 2 o'clock. 2 in the morning. What day of the month was this day that had just begun? He reckoned it up from the date of his mother's funeral. The fatal parallel was complete. It was his birthday. Had he escaped the mortal peril which his dream foretold, or had he only received a second warning? As this ominous doubt forced itself on his mind, he stopped, reflected, and turned back again towards the city. He was still resolute to hold to his word, and never to let her see him more. But there was a thought now in his mind of having her watched and followed. The knife was in his possession, the world was before him, but a new distrust of her, a vague, unspeakable, superstitious dread had overcome him. "I must know where she goes, now she thinks I have left her," he said to himself as he stole back wearily to the precincts of his house. It was still dark. He had left the candle burning in the bedchamber, But when he looked up to the window of the room now, there was no light in it. He crept cautiously to the house door. On going away, he remembered to have closed it. On trying it now, he found it open. He waited outside, never losing sight of the house till daylight. Then he ventured indoors, listened and heard nothing. Looked into kitchen, scullery, parlor, and found nothing. Went up at last into the bedroom. It was empty. A picklock lay on the floor, betraying how she had gained entrance in the night, and that was the only trace of her. Whither had she gone? No mortal tongue could tell him. The darkness had covered her flight, and when the day broke, no man could say where the light found her. Before leaving the house and the town forever, he gave instructions to a friend and neighbor to sell his furniture for anything that it would fetch, and to apply the proceeds towards employing the police to trace her. The directions were honestly followed, and the money was all spent. But the inquiries led to nothing. The picklock on the bedroom floor remained the last useless trace of the dream woman. At this part of the narrative, the landlord paused, and turning towards the window of the room in which we were sitting, looked in the direction of the stable yard. "So far," he said, "I tell you what was told to me. The little that remains to be added lies within my own experience. Between 2 and 3 months after the events I have just been relating, Isaac Scatcherd came to me, withered and old-looking before his time, just as you saw him today. He had his testimonials to character with him, and he asked me for employment here. Knowing that my wife and he were distantly related, I gave him a trial in consideration of that relationship, and liked him in spite of his strange habits. He is as sober, honest, and willing a man as there is in England. As for his restlessness at night, and his sleeping away his leisure time in the day, who can wonder it after hearing his story? Besides, he never objects to being roused up when he's wanted, so there's not much inconvenience to complain of, after all. I suppose he is afraid of a return of that dreadful dream, and of waking out of it in the dark?" "No," returned the landlord. "The dream comes back to him so often that he has got to bear with it by this time resignedly enough. It's his wife keeps him waking at night, as he has often told me."
"What? Has she never been heard of yet?"
"Never. Isaac himself has the one perpetual thought that she is alive and looking for him. I believe he wouldn't let himself drop off to sleep towards 2 in the morning for a king's ransom. 2 in the morning, he says, is the time she will find him, one of these days. 2 in the morning is the time, all the year round, when he likes to be most certain that he has got the clasp knife safe about him. He does not mind being alone as long as he is awake, except on the night before his birthday, when he firmly believes himself to be in peril of his life. The birthday has only come round once since he has been here, and then he sat up alone with a night porter. 'She's looking for me,' is all he says when anybody speaks to him about the one anxiety of his life. 'She's looking for me.' He may be right. She may be looking for him. Who can tell?"
"Who can tell?" said I.
"Certainly an unnerving story, as usual. I'll be back with more unnerving stories next time. As usual, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners. I enjoyed reading to you, and I hope you enjoyed listening."